Running a business shouldn't feel like surviving a software group project. One app for accounting, another for inventory, another for sales, and somehow none of them talk to each other. That's where Odoo comes in, an all-in-one business management software that brings every part of your business together, from sales and accounting to inventory and marketing, all in one powerful platform. No messy integrations, no bouncing between tabs, and best of all, no spreadsheets. Stop managing software and start managing your business with one unified system. Try for free today at odoo.com/iHeartRadio. That's odoo.com/iHeartRadio.
This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.A. Mackinder, International Relations, Five Capitals. We go to Kyiv. Professor, the Russian military commander known as General Armageddon, his pet name, has stabilized Russia's front lines in Ukraine since taking over in October, goes the report from London. Analysts say that General Suravikin's organizational abilities and ruthlessness made him a dangerous adversary. He's probably the most competent commander Russia has put in place so far, said a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. What he's meaning to do is to freeze the civilian population left inside Ukraine, to make it impossible to heat, and we know the temperatures can go to minus 20 degrees centigrade, which is much colder than human beings can stand. Your measure, Professor, will this work on a depopulated, deracinated country?
Well, I would have to say that General Sorokin is he may be the best commander they have, but he's a borderline mafioso as far as his whole career goes. He's not a, but he is certainly better than who they've had before. So we're starting to see tens of thousands of Russians being, you know, thrown into battles, and the Ukrainians being pushed back by that. Having said that, though, I think that that this is not going to make a strategic difference. I don't think that the cold is going to be decisive. If we look at World War I, World War II, the Korean War, it's certainly true at the reservoir in Korea that, you know, 30,000 Chinese troops froze to death and so forth. I'm not making light of this at all. But in war, things get done that have to be done for military purposes. And I think that what's happening, what we're seeing in the war between Ukraine and Russia is a slow, but nonetheless an almost inexorable process of Russia slowly being defeated. I think we all have a sense that Russia is not immovable in the way that she seemed to be earlier. That said, however, I think they're very, very far from wanting to make a compromise. So I think we're going to see some escalation in that theater, lots of explosions inside Russia, lots of ghastly damage to the western part of Ukraine, which has been basically free of Russian attack recently because of Surovikin's idea, comparable to the Allied war idea in World War II. We discovered we couldn't hit a factory with a bomb, so we changed the dehousing campaign. If you can find the city, just drop stuff on the city, you're bound to hit something. I think the bridge and the Sea of Azov may suddenly come up. I'm sure that the Ukrainians are working on a way of blowing up the bridge. Also, I would argue that Russia is weakening herself. She's using up her own resources, and she has turned out to lack the ability, on which I think she counted, and on which in a way we did too, that she would be able to use Washington and Brussels and so forth to pressure Ukraine to make a settlement. I don't think really there's going to be a settlement until Putin leaves. I think that the Russians are they're thinking right now about what to do next. And as I said, we're only 290 days into the war. Now, the Ukrainians have got serious problems with supply and with repair and terrible, terrible damage to their civilian infrastructure. But the effect of this is that her allies are beginning to understand that this is not some sort of a UN pantomime about peacekeeping and war, but this is absolutely dead serious. So a hard core of allies is forming around Ukraine. And we see, it hasn't been noted, but the allies have basically closed the Black Sea and the Baltic to the Russian navies. This is, that's not quite the last turn of the spigot has not quite occurred yet, but they are in a position to do that. So for the first time, 290 days in, I think the world is beginning to understand the full strategic significance of this, what we thought was going to be a short, easy graduate school war in Ukraine. And we have realized that it is imperative that Russia be defeated.
We'll go to Brussels, the headquarters of both the European Union and NATO. The significant development of the week is the oil price cap and the weather. Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, commenting on five capitals in conflict in Europe, in a European-scale war. The news of the week is the oil price cap, which was effective at first, and the price is now stabilized. There's no particular shock in oil. It's been expensive for a while. It's not as expensive as it was at the beginning of the Ukraine conflict. However, the news of Europe is not going in a positive direction. You will remember there was a balmy period in November. Well, Bloomberg is now reporting Arctic weather finally hits Europe. We'll test energy supplies. I've talked to several European principal states in the last week. It is much colder in London, much colder in Berlin. It is temperate to cold in southern France, and it is temperate to much cooler in Italy, in northern Italy. Those four states, France, Britain, Germany, and Italy, are the founders of the European Union and are principals in NATO. So that's why I watch them very carefully. However, all of the European Union now must deal with gas supplies topped up. They filled their gas storage before the cutoff from Russia's oil, natural gas. However, their ability to generate electricity is challenged because much of the heating, as I understand it, in Europe is done by electricity in floorboards, unlike how America does its heating, which is steam heating radiators or heating from oil. Europe uses electricity, which is generated by oil supplies and by natural gas supplies and by coal supplies and by, in France's condition, nuclear energy. Professor, the Brussels has a simultaneous task. The EU must satisfy its population, which is right now aware of the fact that they've got to moderate their electricity use. And it must also satisfy NATO, where the anxiety in NATO is obvious at all times, but especially in these last days, because NATO sees the widening war, which you just explicated. NATO's willing to say that things worry them so much that they're concerned about the war turning into a much darker contest between NATO and Moscow. So two questions. One, how do you measure the EU standing up to the cold temperatures, Arctic temperatures? And two, how do you measure NATO now concerned about the widening war?
Well, the effect of constant cold and frozen hands and all the rest on a big population like Europe's, which we're counting on, is not to be underestimated. If you look at the history of the French Revolution and the exit from the Revolution and the rise of Napoleon, you discover that the winter of 1794-95 was unprecedented in historical records. It was so cold, and the Seine froze and all the rest. And that didn't really have any political significance, except for the fact that it really had an effect on the way people felt and how politics happened. And I think that's the situation that we're going to face in Europe. I don't believe that they're actually going to freeze to death, but this is an exogenous factor. It's got nothing to do with the logic of geopolitics, but it is going to have an effect on it's going to make the Europeans start thinking, God damn it, why are we messed up in this thing anyway? Why can't the Russians send us oil? It also shows that Putin's no fool. He says, okay, I won't sell it to you. Now, he probably will have problems. What's he going to do? I mean, if you have a gusher, the first thing you have to do is cap it. I don't know how much oil the Russians can store, but this is... It's irrelevant to the main thing, yet it is very, very important. Now, if we turn to things that actually have a military connection or a strategic connection, direct connection to Ukraine, the first thing, we have the warning from Mr. Medvedev, Mr. Bear, that we can't supply Patriot missiles to Ukraine. Now, of course, we have to supply Patriot missiles to Ukraine, not least because if Mr. Medvedev tells us we can't do it and then we don't, that's very, very bad. So there's that issue, and that's causing some debate in Europe and some dissension among the allies. I would stress, I think, that at the end of this, we're going to see several NATO allies who will have really made themselves very powerful militarily, and some others who will turn out to be free riders and will be saying, my goodness, how are we going to get anybody to defend us, seeing as how we didn't do much last time around. We have the fact that the Europeans are pledging 10 billion euros to Ukraine, and this in spite of an attempted veto by Hungary. And I'm not familiar with the ins and outs of this, but the fact that they've managed to get it around the Hungarian veto suggests to me that they have a real concern. They're starting to understand that money is not just something they have to do to please the Americans or something. This has to do with their own survival as independent countries. In other words, they're starting to understand why they need the U.S. And if there's one last point to be made about NATO, I think the most striking thing is that in the last week, it's been announced that Britain and Italy are joining with Japan on Japan's ongoing and hitherto Japanese-British project, first Japanese, then Japanese-British, now Japanese-British-Italian project to build a fighter jet that's much better than anything we have. And I have no doubt that they're going to succeed. What's significant here is that those are all countries that are looking for allies, and they haven't come around and said, why don't you Americans join in on this? They said, look, we three can build a fighter that's as good as anything they can build in America or better. And probably it's a good idea if we start to learn to work together just in case something went wrong with our connections with America. And this is a very important development.
Professor H.J. McIntyre, international relations, commenting on Brussels. We're headed to Beijing because, surprisingly, Xi Jinping, the general secretary for the remainder of his life, as far as we can understand, has commented in an unusual fashion about the Ukraine conflict during his embassy to Riyadh to meet with the leadership in Saudi Arabia. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.